This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Jawley. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Acast, Spotify or wherever you listen and get my daily Red Box morning email. Go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox. Right, down to business. This week I'm delighted to be joined by Frances Gibb, making her first appearance on the Red Box podcast and sadly her last. It's the last week at the Times having covered the law for the paper since 1982. We'll discuss what's changed and what hasn't since then. Times columnist Daniel Finkelstein explains why he thinks a general election would be mad. But first, Sam Coates, the Times deputy political editor, on who he thinks is to blame for everything.
Say it once. Say it a thousand times. I do wonder whether there is much in modern politics that can't be laid at Theresa May's door. We have a leader who doesn't lead, lowering the bar for everyone else in politics. Are politicians just getting worse, or am I getting older?
What a nice cheery note to start on, Sam. So, why is everything Theresa May's fault?
If you look at the papers this morning and the coverage of the Nissan row. So Nissan have announced that they're not going to make one of the off-roaders in Britain, which they had in 2016 promised to build here. Essentially, it's a bitter, bitter disagreement between Remainers, who all seem to be blaming Brexit, and Leavers, who seem to be pointing to the decline of diesel and the internal problems of Nissan and sort of anything but Brexit. You've just got this sense of an unbridgeable divide between two camps who don't agree, not just on the arguments, but they don't even agree on a common set of facts. And here we are, 2.5 years after the referendum and less than 60 days to go until we theoretically leave the European Union. And none of the divisions have healed. In fact, my sense very, very strongly is that the divisions in the country are worse than they were 2.5 years ago. And this argument that's going on in politics this week between the kind of the Malthouse compromise and the Brady plan and this plan and that plan, essentially different groups of people arguing over what the vision for Britain should be. Should it be a bit more of a low tax, low regulation sort of Singapore type country, or should it be quite similar to what it is at the moment? And that isn't settled. And that big picture debate and the failure to bring the nation together after the 2016 referendum, I am today laying at the feet of the Right Honourable Theresa May. Because if there had been a Prime Minister...
Just to be clear, Danny's got his head in his hands. But anyway, you carry on.
Don't worry.
Could anybody else have done better? I would just like to ask, could anybody else have done better? We were always going to get a bloody nose from the EU.
It is a classic example of something called the fundamental attribution error, which is to attribute to the characteristics of a person what are, in fact, the characteristics of a situation.
I haven't even finished. Already we're into the rebuttal.
There was hope for
I mean, there was a lot of... I was hoping that the tide hasn't broken of my argument.
Go ahead, sorry.
No hope, Danny. Just get that in your head.
Let Danny make the counter case. Why is everything not Theresa May's
fault? I'm completely open to criticism of it. I, for example, think that for the Conservative Party to have done what it did, which is to pursue entirely the Leave vote, it is partly responsible for that, for the situation, and she certainly played her role in that. So I'm not totally dismissing what you say. But obviously the split in the nation is not down to her. Now, the other night, somebody was saying to me, you know, how does David Cameron sleep at night? So people blame him, right? And what the only people no one ever blames are themselves, you know, which is we don't ever blame ourselves for a big political round, which we find it difficult ourselves to make common cause or even understand the other people's point of view, to the point where David Cameron's blamed because he made the mistake of asking people what they thought, and everyone blames him for the fact that the country then expressed what it thought, and half the country doesn't like that.
But we're agreeing not to blame David Cameron because we're today blaming Theresa May.
Well, she did, of course, call the election and thereby lose her majority and thereby get herself on this petard that she's now on with the DUP.
You have somebody in number 10 who is incapable, and feel free to disagree with me on this specific point, Danny, who is incapable of taking the nation with her. She is incapable of painting a vision of a better tomorrow that sounds like something that Leavers and Remainers can jointly sign up to as a common destination.
Well, what is that?
So I don't know what it is, but the job of good politicians. Let's narrow in on one specific that you said. Yes, she pursued the Leave vote, Leave voters as a path to electoral triumph in the 2017 general election with Boadicea, Mark 17 and all of that standing out nonsense standing outside number 10. But who are the people who are most angry? Who are the people who are most divided? Who are the people who are most dissatisfied with the plan that Theresa May has come up with? Despite all of her botched attempts to bring them with her, she hasn't even brought the Leavers with
her. But it's not her fault, that's their fault, right? So the reason why I object to it is because it shifts responsibility from people to some mythical power that Theresa May, I admit, does not possess to persuade people out of their delusions, right? But she's not responsible for the delusionary view that the European Union is going to remove altogether the backstop when it isn't going to. She has attempted to explain to the House of Commons precisely that it was not the case that that would happen, but has been forced through the weakness of her political position into having to make some effort to do that.
That is an absolute counsel of despair.
Yes.
Suggesting that the person in number 10 can't shape and improve and in some way begin to heal the scars of the nation. Everybody, not her talent.
If your analysis was limited to that point, then I wouldn't have had so much objection to it. But you went further than that and said that there wasn't a problem in British politics that couldn't be laid at her door, which went from making a tenable proposition to making a preposterous one.
Clearly we can argue that Jeremy Corbyn's lack of tie and Vince Cable's lack of political success can't entirely be put down to Theresa May. Well, and sometimes you make a point
For instance, let's say that Jeremy Corbyn, for example, was an enthusiastic Remainer and decided on a second referendum. The situation in the country would be very different. So he has also made some choices. We've all, and let's assume Jacob Rees-Mogg didn't take the position that he took, and there are lots of people who've taken positions for which they must take responsibility. And I'm no different from anyone else from that, right? Because, for instance, I supported having a referendum. Lots of people think that's to blame for the situation. To try to take all of that and blame it on Theresa May, well, it certainly puts his finger on a weakness, right, which she does have, but also a strength. One of her strengths is she's trying to plough through the middle, almost impervious to humiliation, to get a solution at the end of the day without necessarily saying where she wants to go. But that's also a weakness. But your assumption, which is that were she to have said more clearly where she wanted to go, would have made a huge amount of difference. I think that's over-optimistic.
She spent a long time because she was not saying where she wanted to go, she created the space for everyone to take fanciful positions, as you were talking about. A prime example being, about this time last year, there was an argument between Max Fack and whatever, I don't remember what the other one was, regulatory something or others, and instead of taking a position, she set up two cabinet working groups. And so, yes, publicly, members of her cabinet wedded themselves to one of them.
Split on that.
But instead of her taking a position saying, this is what we're doing, she ended up eventually taking a position with half the cabinet on the record disagreeing with her. And that's why they then resigned.
I was critical of the decision to throw all behind the Leave, and the red lines. And I haven't agreed with her position on the customs union. I think occasionally I've been critical that what is going to become obvious she hasn't decided earlier when it's kind of coming down the road. Yeah. But the idea, for example, that before she became Prime Minister, we were fundamentally united and that she's sort of riven the nation apart, kind of misses out the fact she wasn't Prime Minister during the referendum, for example.
But I think
so
in the end,
to blame it all on her is ridiculous.
But in the end, we're defending, you're defending the absence of something. The absence of a big political figure who is taking us further. But here's one
no,
other
I'm not.
Path.
I think that people would recognise that she does have a quality that is very useful, right? Which is that she's persistently attempting to unify Parliament behind a deal, right? And she got the deal
without
out of the
explaining
European
it and without bringing people.
Well, I would like to ask one very basic layman's question: who could have done a better job? And when we don't have her, who is the next person going to be?
Great question.
Well, who is it?
I don't know. Let's ask Danny.
That's not a question for me. It's a question your analysis poses, right? Because I think France put a foot through your analysis, really. Which is if it's all her fault, there must have been another person or
well,
another
Well, I'll tell you what, we've talked about this on the podcast before, that I have changed my mind. I thought actually having a Remainer as Prime Minister back in June, July 2016 was probably the right thing to do to help bring the country together. Actually, I do now wonder, had it been a Leaver, had it been Michael Gove, who got up every morning thinking Brexit was a good idea, which Theresa May clearly doesn't, and actually went around telling everyone it was a good idea, and if we all got together, it might be better. And a Leaver reaching out to Remainers would have been less divisive.
I'll tell you what the hole in that is. It would still have been a rubbish idea, right? lots of the discussion about the negotiation always takes place as if there wasn't another party to it, but there is. The European
but
Union
you, there isn't,
was involved
there isn't,
in it.
You think that Theresa May is literally the best person that we could have had?
Yes, actually.
And still.
I do take that view. I mean, Matthew Paris, after the general election, argued that Theresa May should resign, and I thought that it was quite a compelling point, until I began to think of how you would move from that situation. So the situation was very poor, and in those circumstances, there wasn't any other candidate who could tenably win who was anywhere near as good as her, and I've never felt since then that it was a good idea to replace her. So that's why my answer to that question is yes. Is she the paragon of all virtues? No, clearly Sam has put his finger on some critical points about her, which are serious problems. You know, her withholding nature certainly is a serious problem. The inability to communicate with colleagues is certainly a serious problem. I'm not uncritical or incapable of seeing what's before my eyes, but the idea that the split in the country, which is about very fundamental long-term trends and which divides people on social class lines, is the only thing I just think is rubbish.
Okay, well, let's move on, but I'm sort of slightly staying on Theresa May's merits as Prime Minister. Should we have another general election? This is Daniel Finkelstein.
Well, for the Tories to contemplate a deliberate election, it would, whatever the polls might say, be absolutely insane. And I can only imagine that all this election talk is basically about preparing for an accidental election.
So, Danny, over the weekend, there were stories in the Sunday papers, excitable stories in the Sunday papers, D-Day being lined up. A D-Day election in June, apparently, was one option.
About before the election that she held last time, when it was announced that the podium was being placed in Downing Street, I incautiously said it won't be an election. This is because I had excellent sources who told me that it wasn't going to... quorum election, right? The lesson I learned from that was trust your political analysis, right? And the political analysis was this is quite a good time to call an election. Actually, before I rethought that and realised that was probably an incomplete analysis, but anyway, at the time, all of my bells were saying call an election, and then I thought she isn't going to call an election because someone told me she wouldn't. Well, so now I'm determined to rely more on my political instincts and analysis. And I don't think it's a good time to call an election. There is one reason for calling an election now, which is nothing to do with Brexit, and that is to do with the fact that real incomes are rising, and it's better to call an election when real incomes are rising. And that probably, in a state we don't discuss it much, is probably buoying the Tory percentage in the polls more than we think. However, when you take into account everything else, the fact that it's an attempt to win a fourth election in a row, the fact that the Conservative Party has got a leader who has said that she wants to stand down, who'd then have to fight this election, and the fact that it has no policy on, you know, the Brexit split isn't going to go away just because, even if the withdrawal agreement is agreed, which was one of the sort of posits behind this election, I think it would be insane to hold an election, so much so that I'm pretty sure that they're not contemplating doing that. What I suspect is happening is that the chances of an accidental election, which are, I think, reasonably high, they're not overpowering, but I think there's a possibility that the Brexit negotiations will get nowhere and that the no-to-no dealers will bail out on the government.
So the sort of Remainer Tories
just enough,
would
the Remainer Tories
withdraw
might.
Support for the government, yes. So it loses a confidence vote. Jeremy Corbyn tries to cobble together government, doesn't work over 2 weeks, and then we just have a general election.
Yes.
Sam, what do you think? Are we heading for the polls?
So at a point at which the, as it were, executive, the government, Downing Street, is fundamentally at odds with the legislature, the Commons, MPs, the only way that our system has to resolve that is to have a general election. Now, we've got lots and lots of kind of problems with that. Fixed Term Parliaments Act and all the rest of it. People essentially now, like they never have had to in the past, have to make a proactive choice on the governing side to have a general election. But that nevertheless is the situation. And there aren't many options in Theresa May's toolbox for what to do to avoid and to advance an argument that isn't advancing very far, quite fast. And so it does remain a possibility. You know, Danny's absolutely right. There's nobody in their right minds in the Conservative Party would be planning for an election right now, because you saw that spike post-election being called for Labour last time round. And I'm quite sure that in, you know, places like Middlesbrough, Nicky Morgan's seat and all along those kind of Tory seats along the M4 belt, they live in fear of that happening again. And to be honest, as austerity continues to be in place, which it is still at the moment, we've got, you know, spending review soon, which might change that. But at the moment, budgets are still going down. People are hurting, and they could potentially react accordingly, like they did in 2017. So it's an enormous
really,
risk.
Because we're going down in 2017, so that is a slight difference. But I think the biggest problem the Conservative Party would have with putting together a programme and also coming behind the leader. To my mind, there's such a sort of unity of view among Conservatives that I speak to that this wouldn't be a good idea. That you can only see it happening by accident, but it could. Yeah. That absolutely could, and so therefore. The party chairman is right to prepare the party for that possibility, because it's a real possibility.
So, Francis, does the idea of a general election fill you with joy?
Another one, as Brenda would say in Bristol. Well, I mean, it neither fills me with joy or horror. I mean, I can't see the point of it, frankly, at this stage of the game. I mean, we're at such a critical stage. Well, that would just hold everything up, put a delay into the proceedings. What would be the point of it? We might get a different government, I suppose, and then they'll have to start all over again.
And that's part of the problem, isn't it, Sam? The public, already sick, we were talking on the podcast last week about all the polling and focus groups, the public are sick of talking about Brexit and why can't they just sort out all of that. The sort of public reaction to what would to them seem like another unnecessary intrusion on their daily lives and having to go out and vote again, there's no way of knowing how that would play out either.
No. I do think post-Brexit, structurally, the British public are going to have to get used to something new, which is the evolution of what, for want of a better term, I would call cliff-edge politics. We've got a cliff-edge at the moment. It's March 29th, the day we leave the European Union. If we don't get a deal, then bad things will allegedly happen, and you know it's an important moment we've got to get through. But then we've got to negotiate a full deal, and then at the end of that negotiating period, if we haven't done that, there'll be another cliff edge. I think cliff edge politics will be with us for the rest of our political reporting lives, as far as I can see, because there's always going to be deals to be tweaked with the European Union, reviews going on, threats from the EU to pull where we are, general elections that change things, leadership contests that are won on the basis of changing the terms of our relationship with the EU as a third country. And I think that cliff edge politics is a thing. So I think Brenda's just got to get a grip and get used to it, because those cliff edges are going to trigger, like dominoes, more electoral events. And I think the cycle of British politics being less secure, I mean, political journalists probably benefit, but I'm not sure who else does, is just now going to become a structural feature of where we are. What do you think about
well,
that, Danny?
I think what you may be pointing to is that the political party system will be in flux. Mm. That clearly, because one of the reasons for waiting for a general election, if you're a Conservative, is that one of the ways the Conservative Party could win the election is if the Labour Party splits. It won't, it appears, do so until after the Brexit situation is sorted. It may not do so in a very big way. I've never particularly thought that it that a new party would be successful, but that doesn't mean it won't happen and that it wouldn't be damaging to Labour, which is a different thing. And so the Conservatives want to wait for that. I agree with Sam that we may have a more unstable politics, but I think one of the reasons for that is that the party system, the split between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party is probably not in the right place. That Tony Blair, you know, who's very perceptive student of politics, when he said before he resigned as Prime Minister, that we were going to move to an open versus closed debate. I think that is the direction in which we're going, but how exactly that manifests itself is not the moment.
Because I'm not sure which is the open and which is the closed party.
Correct. Because at the moment, both parties have got a mixture.
And both parties are kind of, you know, but in particular, I mean, weirdly, the Labour Party is led by a leader who's more inclined to closed than the Conservative Party, although she clearly was tempted with the sort of Lancaster
House. Or to put it in my words, you know, you're in a balloon with Richard Bergen and Daniel Kaczynski. What happens next?
Well, that's an entirely different question. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking to Frances as her almost 40 years of covering the law for The Times comes to an end, the highlights and lowlights and how much they drank at lunchtime. We'll be back after this short break.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Red Box Politics podcast on The Times. I'm Matt Jolly, joined in the studio by Sam Coates, Daniel Finkelstein, and this is Frances Gibb.
Hello. Much has changed during 4 decades covering the law for The Times. The legal profession is now a vast industry. The justice system is badly cash-starved in a way it wasn't decades ago. And for better or worse, there are fewer big personalities or big beasts.
So, Frances, you've been covering the law for The Times since 1982. And you wrote a brilliant piece in last week's paper, sort of trying to sum all that up in one piece. And it struck me that I suppose there were a couple of things I want to talk to you about. Partly, how has the job changed and the job of being a reporter for The Times? And then how has the legal system and that sort of thing changed? So let's start with the job in particular.
As in all areas of journalism, the job has changed, probably mainly because of the internet. I mean, not entirely. I mean, just going back to the actual area of legal affairs, it was quite a small and probably important but side stream of the main news coverage. It wasn't mainstream as it is now. And that is evident by the fact that I was able to go and do it part-time at various stages when I went on maternity leave 3 times. So there's that difference. And we didn't have rival magazines. We didn't have the legal trade press that all developed. So much change in the 80s, which made it suddenly a great big burgeoning area to cover. On top of that, of course, you've got the change that all journalists face with the internet, the arrival of the internet. You know, when I started, it was literally was typewriters, four copies of blacks, as we used to call them. One went off to the printers, one went to the sub-editors, or the other way around. And phoning in from phone boxes, usually never working. No mobiles. Can you imagine? Very, very different time.
Francis, what we really want to know is you pitched up in the morning. Now, did you go into the office or did you go into the pub? Where was the business really done? How did it work? Can you sketch out what a 1982 day in the life of the Times looked like?
Yes, very, very slow pace compared with now. And the beauty of it, probably one story or two at most. So you might pitch up to the office in the morning, but then there'd always be lunch. Lunch with a contact and people would drink, you know, unlike now. And then you'd come back.
How
and
much?
You might, I don't know about everybody else, but I'd probably have half a bottle.
And what, then, what was the most you ever had at lunch? Or your contact ever had at lunch?
I think if there was a large quantity, I won't be remembering it.
So. It's not actually a cross-examination. I think Sam's mistaken substance for content.
Yes, I think it's interesting. So you're so concerned about the quantity that we used to drink in those days.
Yes,
Enough to forget. But the point is, you come back well-oiled. And I also had experience of this before the Times for a couple of years on the Telegraph, and it was particularly the case. You'd come back reasonably well-oiled, you'd write your one story, and that would pretty well be it. And it was a lovely, slow pace. You didn't have deadlines, as we have now, all through the day, you know, online by 11 and midday and all the way the rest of it.
Was there more news editing? Was there more sense of what they wanted from the paper, or was it more up to you than it is today? I mean, how's the relationship between the bosses and the writers changed over that period?
I think it was much more left to you. There was news editing, but they would very gently say, perhaps we could have this in the intro. Whereas now, as we all know, to our cost, the news desk will rewrite. Several people on the news desk might rewrite your intro, might get done several times.
Just for the tape, I don't mind that at all. I'd completely relax with whatever they come out with.
The way that operated, and then, as I say, getting out of London was another great difference. I mean, now, because of the demands of the internet, and paradoxically, in one way, that's been a great freedom creator. You know, you can get information so quickly, you don't have to trail over to the library and get out a dusty old file of cuttings to research a story. Now you can get it in 5 minutes on the internet.
You were a pioneer, Francis, partly because you were not, your background wasn't legal, and your brilliant piece, you mention how some people responded to this in the profession. In retrospect, were they wrong? And secondly, how does that make you feel when, for example, during Chris Grayling's tenure, lots of lawyers said, you know, the problem is the Lord Chancellor must be a lawyer.
Yes.
And I was thinking, well, also the Lord Chancellor must be a consumer of law as well. Not just a producer of
Absolutely.
It. So what did you think of both those things?
Well, they're two good points. I mean, I obviously think and hope they were wrong. I mean, obviously, I hope I've proved that. And interestingly, I think that's evident by the fact that now people would not look to a lawyer any more than they look to a doctor to cover health. They wouldn't look to a lawyer to cover law. I hope so, anyway. But as to the Chris Grayling point, I actually agree with you. I don't think the Lord Chancellor needs to be a lawyer, that the legal profession, as we know, have made much of that. But I think it's evidenced by the fact that they absolutely adored Michael Gove, who wasn't a lawyer. So it's more down to the individual and whether they've got the requisite understanding of the position of law and the judiciary in our constitution.
So it's not about being a lawyer, it's about being Chris Grayling that's the problem.
Exactly.
Who'd have thought?
So, Francis, we live today in the Me Too era, where people talk about their experiences, women talk about their experiences in male-dominated in work environments. But in 1982, you were a senior Times journalist in what would have been a completely male-dominated newsroom. What was that like? How did that manifest itself? What was the behaviour like?
I think it was very, very different. I mean, although I did get my 3 periods of maternity leave, not for the 1 year, I hasten to say, that you get now, you then shut up about the fact you'd had children. You didn't even mention it. You certainly never raised it as an excuse for leaving or not getting to something. You absolutely pretended it hadn't happened. And there were very few of us. In fact, I can't even remember anybody else who was having children at that stage. And I do remember when I joined the Times, and it was as a general reporter in those days, and they said, oh, go and find yourself a spare desk, because they did exist. And I went over to one corner of the room, and one of the other few female reporters said, don't come here, don't come here. She said, your mate, it's a women's area. So she kind of hasted me off.
And were men who worked at the Times in 1982 enlightened?
I think journalism has always been more enlightened. I mean, certainly Charlie Wilson, who allowed me to go part-time to do the job. Yes, I mean, he was pretty enlightened. I mean, having said that, he did say, yes, you can do the same job. That'd be great. You can do it in half the time, and that will be on half the money, of course.
And what about... Because, I mean, to do one beat at one paper for such a length of time... I mean, I occasionally have, you know, in the depths of Brexit despair, have pangs of maybe I should go and do arts or something. Just whether or not I could carry on doing... covering politics for another 30 years.
Still be covering Brexit.
Yes, exactly. Was there ever a point where you got bored of it, or does it get better and better?
No, I think what I usually say when people ask that is the fact that, you know, if you have to work for 9 different editors, every time they come along, you imagine you're going to be sacked. I mean, I never actually thought I would still be in the job beyond the age of 50, and I'm much nearer 70 now than 50. But so every time, as we all know, you have to prove yourself again. You have to think, well, they don't know who I am. Why would they care?
Excluding the current one, because that would be a conflict of interest. Which one was the best and which one was the worst?
Well, I think Peter Starthorpe was very good, partly because of his longevity. He did a decade. He promoted and created the law section, which at that time was possible because of the burgeoning legal advertising market, which has since fallen away. So he was very good in that respect. Charlie Wilson, I already mentioned, because he allowed me to go part-time and enabled me to have my family. And... worst, I know I'm not going to be called on that one. I don't want to be liable. At this stage of the game.
You can tell me.
I've already been sued for contempt of court once, and I don't want to.
What happened?
You can tell me when the button's turned off.
Yeah. Well, no, I was taken to court and cost the Times £15,000, and I have to say, in my defence, it all went through our legal department, but nonetheless, you know, contempt of court for speaking to a juror. That was that.
In terms of highlights and lowlights, you talked about some of the things. Derry Irving calling you a silly goose for basically writing down something he'd said and putting it in the paper. Is that right?
I had an interview with Derry Irving, and he gave me, as part of this, a speech he'd given. No one had picked it up, so it was effectively like an exclusive. And in the middle of this speech, he was drawing parallels between his position and that of Cardinal Wolsey. And at that time, there'd been a lot of stories, you may remember or you may not, yeah, about the cost of lavishly, you know, his money he'd spent on his apartments. £650,000 worth of very, very expensive wallpaper, Pugin-style wallpaper. And so, of course, the tabloids absolutely loved this story, which we put on the front, and it went crazy. And everybody did mock-ups of Irving as Cardinal Wolsey. And I don't think people never really forgot it.
I had a very funny thing with that, because I was working for William Hague at the time.
Oh, yes.
Derry Irving was right about the wallpaper, but I also thought that it was the most... unbelievable thing. He obviously thought that the more he went on about it, eventually all the tabloid newspapers would go, oh yes, you're right, and start. And I've never seen anybody who just couldn't accept the realities of politics. He kept plunging on with this thing, which was a total loser, even though I could see why he was a bit frustrated, because it wasn't obviously up to him what wallpaper got put in the Palace of Westminster. And he was right, you can't. But how he thought that if you went to a committee and said, I can't just put it up from B&Q, that would go down in the newspapers.
I mean, he probably was right, but I think the trouble with him, it was the combination of all that, plus his very grandiose and sort of arrogant demeanour, always boasting about how he chaired 4 cabinet subcommittees and all the rest of it, and was responsible for devolution, the Human Rights Act, and it was that, wasn't it?
I was working at the time with George Osborne, and George was very defensive of his right to put up very expensive wallpaper, and I kept teasing George as to the reason why possibly he felt the company might be in for some business.
So, Francis, if you took a step back and looked at the way the legal profession is covered across the last 30 years, what's done well and what's done less well? I mean, take the way that legal aid is covered, often a tabloid whipping horse, or the way that judges are talked about. Is that still a bit too deferential? If you look across the piece at the way the legal profession is written about in newspapers and now in blogs and on Twitter, what's done right and what's done wrong?
I think there's a big difference between, I would say this, but tabloids and what were broadsheets. I mean, I think, as you say, legal aid is always going to be a whipping boy. And I think, you know, the Secret Barrister, the book anonymously by written about the failings of the justice system at the minute under its sort of cash-starved situation, that has had immense success, but would never have made waves in the Mail, I don't think. Because, you know, we like to, I think we write sympathetic pieces about cash-starved barristers, but not many other people get that, and not when they go out on strike and hold their Gucci handbags outside court. It doesn't go down terribly well. So they still got a job of work to do in promoting themselves properly, and if they want to get that message across, they haven't done that brilliantly. Judges, much the same. I mean, you know, nobody wants stories about judges working in offices with buckets and water. They just don't care about that. So again, I think they've got a bit of a job of work to do in PR terms. It's better than it was, to answer your question. I think, well, they didn't care. They didn't care about the publicity 30 years ago. They didn't want it.
Do you think there's been any change in attitude to reoffending, for instance? Because there was a period politically where you couldn't really make a case for softer sentences and greater rehabilitation of offenders. Do you think that any of that is eased up over time?
I think there may be, because of the financial constraints of the situation, you know, people like David Gawk, currently Justice Secretary, could push a bit more than he was able to for things like restorative justice, for things like getting rid of six-month sentences, all those things which would have been absolutely anathema a few years ago under Michael Howard. So I think, yes, I think judges, if you look at them politically, have been, certainly for the last 10, 15 years, quite a liberal bunch. They are. Our judges are liberal. I mean, mostly. And you haven't got the kind of hang and flog and brigade of the early 80s.
What do you plan to do when you're freed from later this week and you hang up your typewriter?
I haven't got a plan B. I don't know. I may do the odd piece for the paper. I may do some obituaries. And I thought I would just pause for breath and see what happens.
Well, we wish you all the very best, Francis. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hopefully you get to ignore Brexit slightly more often than we do. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, wherever you get them from, and sign up to my morning email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, from Sam Coates, Daniel Finkstein, Francis Gibb and me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.